Good afternoon, and welcome to Covington's Financial Services Teleconference Series, Taking Stock: The Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. We thank you for joining us. This is Ann Termine, your host for today's program. I lead Covington's Futures and Derivatives Practice Group, and I'm also a member of the White Collar and Government Investigations Practice Group. This is the sixth session in our weekly series. Today, we will cover key topics involving the United States Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or the CFTC, which is an agency I know well after spending 13 years in its Division of Enforcement, where I led the LIBOR investigations, among other things. In the coming weeks, this webinar series will bring additional presentations covering post-crisis fintech, white collar, litigation, housing, and housing finance updates. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients, and we hope you've been finding them useful. Before we start, we have a few housekeeping items to mention. For CLE, those interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for 0.5 credits in New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked in the reminder notice you received for today's call. You will need to record the affirmation code, which we will share toward the end of today's program, and return the form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiani. Her information is on the form, and she will revert to you with a certificate of attendance in due course. We welcome any questions you may have throughout the program. Please forward your questions to Al McManus at amcmanus@cov.com. We will try to answer as many questions as possible in the time allotted. Again, that email is amcmanus@cov.com. Of course, we would be pleased to connect with you on an individual basis after the presentation if you would like. For today's discussion, we will cover the CFTC's response to COVID-19, provide an update on several recent proposed rules that are of interest to the industry, and discuss the CFTC's division of enforcement, including recent cases brought and trends expected for the remainder of the year. As many of you may already know, the CFTC is in many ways proceeding with business as usual, despite the fact that its entire staff is working remotely, just as we all are. For example, it held a virtual open commission meeting via teleconference on April 14th, in which the commission voted on two final rules and three proposed rules. We'll cover those three rules later. The chairman's agricultural advisory committee met via teleconference on April 22nd. The Division of Enforcement is continuing to pursue its investigations, as indicated by the announced closed commission meeting dealing with enforcement matters that took place just this Monday. Additionally, the Energy and Environmental Markets Advisory Committee, a committee sponsored by Commissioner Berkovitz, is scheduled to take place by teleconference tomorrow, May 7th, during which the pending proposed position limits rule will be discussed. And just announced today, Commissioner Stump's Global Markets Advisory Committee will hold a public teleconference meeting on May 19th and will cover the international response to COVID-19, as well as provide a report and recommendation regarding the implementation of initial margin requirements for non-cleared swaps. Just to note, the topics we cover today will be an overview of the various activities at the CFTC. The materials provided in the link to this webinar will give you further details and analysis on the topics we will cover and includes several related CFTC press releases. So let's begin. Here's an update on CFTC's response to COVID-19. In response, the CFTC's Division of Market Oversight and Division of Swap Dealer and Intermediary Oversight issued a series of no-action letters throughout March and April, each providing various forms of relief to various market participants. These no-action letters generally recognize the disruption to market participants stemming from the inability of employees to be physically present at their normal workstations because of social distancing arrangements, stay-at-home orders, and the like. The first two waves of no-action relief came on March 18th and provided an additional 30 days for swap dealers, futures commission merchants, introducing brokers, and swap execution facilities to file their required Chief Compliance Officer annual reports if such reports were due by September 1st. CEFs were also given an additional 60 days to submit required fourth quarter reports, again, if such reports were due by September 1st. These no-action letters also provided to market participants relaxed requirements to record oil communications, relaxed time stamping requirements, and loosened other audit trail requirements, as well as waived certain physical location requirements for foreign brokers. As the markets continue to experience volatility due to the pandemic, the CFTC responded again on March 20th with no action letters aimed at providing relief to commodity pool operators in the form of relaxed reporting requirements for annual reports, CPO PQR reports, and periodic account statements that may be due at this time. A certain large bank also received specific relief in a no-action letter, which allowed it to exclude energy-related commodity swaps from the calculation to determine whether the bank must register as a major swap participant. Although the CFTC received some criticism for this action, in that it took an action to benefit a single large bank, this likely will not deter the agency from considering institution-specific relief again in the future if market conditions, given the pandemic, warrant it. In the third round of COVID-19 relief, the CFTC issued a no-action letter on March 31st that permits foreign broker affiliates and futures commission merchants to accept orders from U.S. customers in certain circumstances without having to register as an introducing broker. Again, this reflects the agency's awareness that social distancing may impede an institution's ability to properly comply with registration requirements. This is particularly true for large multinational institutions whose employees face differing levels of quarantine depending on the jurisdiction in which they reside. With the passage of the CARES Act and the implementation of the Paycheck Protection Program, something you may have heard about in greater detail on prior webinars in this series, the CFTC next issued relief on April 23rd to FCMs and IBs who received a loan under the Paycheck Protection Program. The relief allows them, under certain specified conditions, to add back to net capital certain amounts from the covered loan. It is important to pay close attention to these specified conditions to avoid scrutiny later down the road. As my colleagues have pointed out in our prior webinars, we expect issues surrounding the implementation of the CARES Act and its programs like Paycheck Protection to continue long after the quarantine ends. It may also spur investigations by the various agencies involved with CARES Act. This no-action relief was filed on April 24th by another no-action letter that suspended the requirement that new principals or new associated persons submit fingerprint verification with their registration application materials. Again, the agency focused on the practicalities of the current situation and the need for people to be able to do their jobs and not be held up by requirements that are impossible to fill at the moment. It is important to note that these no-action letters each come with restrictions or specific conditions and or time limitations. These restrictions and specific conditions must be adhered to closely or market participants could face agency action later on. Further, the time-limited relief provided by some of these no-action letters is quickly coming to expiration over the next few weeks and months. Market participants should pay close attention to these dates so they do not fall outside of the relief requested. This being said, it is likely that the agency would consider extending any relief already given, particularly as different parts of the country and the world set varying timetables to reopen economies and return to normal life. Market participants should examine their operations and determine whether requests for extension on certain of these no-action letters may be needed. Turning now to the agency's recently proposed rules. The agency has been fairly active this year, demonstrating Chairman Tarbert's commitment to pass a number of reforms as quickly as possible, and particularly before the November elections. Per his agenda, the Commission issued proposed or reproposed rules in January, February, and April. Some of these rules are not without controversy among the commissioners, making them unlikely to pass unanimously by the Commission. Republican Commissioner Quintenz recently announced his intent not to seek another term. While he is committed to remain at the agency until a successor has been confirmed, Commissioner Quintenz well notes from his own confirmation process that selecting and confirming a new commissioner can take a significantly long time. As such, he has set October 31st as his final day at the CFTC. This makes it all the more imperative for Chairman Tarver to get the rules finalized as soon as possible while the Republicans still have a majority vote on the commission. This may be why, when the commission voted on April 10th to extend the comment period of some of the rules, due to the disruption caused by the pandemic, the commission opted to provide only a couple of days or weeks extension time. Perhaps in a sign of things to come, the measure only passed on a 3-2 majority vote, with both Democratic commissioners dissenting on the basis that the extensions were too short. Now the deadlines for the proposed rules are fast approaching. To the extent that market participants want to submit comments, they should do so soon. As of today, there have been relatively few to no substantive comments filed on the rules as yet. It is also important to note that the proposed rules, if they become final, will impact companies' policies and procedures, requiring them to be reviewed and updated in short order. Next, we will provide a short summary of the pending proposed rules, noting the upcoming closing comment periods. Again, more information on these rules is contained in the materials provided. First is the position limits for derivatives rule. The current version of this long-beleaguered proposed rule applies speculative position limits to a wider range of contracts than the 9 agricultural contracts currently subject to federal position limits. It also provides additional exemptions for such limits, including the expansion of the bona fide hedging exemption. Many will recall that this is the 4th attempt by the Commission to bring this rule. Chairman Tarbert has maintained his commitment to passing this last mandate of the Dodd-Frank Act. And while many have praised the balanced approach that this version of the proposed rule takes to implementing such a controversial topic, it is unlikely to pass without a dissent from the Democratic commissioners, making it necessary to have the chairman and his 2 fellow Republican commissioners available to carry the passage of the final rule. This version of the rule was proposed on January 30th, with the closing day for comments now extended to May 15th. The swap execution facility requirements and real-time reporting requirements proposed rule. The proposed rule addresses certain issues related to the CFTC's CEF regulations that were identified and addressed in various prior letters granting no action relief. In many cases, this proposed rule codifies such relief. Topics in this proposed rule include error trades, block trades, and the execution of package transactions. Overall, the proposal presents a pared-down version of the massive overhaul of CEF trading previously proposed by former Chairman Chris Giancarlo. This revised rule was originally proposed on January 30th, with a closing date for comments now extended to May 22nd. Next is certain swap data repository and data reporting requirements. The proposed rule amends Part 49, which, as many of you know, governs swap data repository registration requirements, SDR operational duties, and the Commission's oversight over SDRs generally. The proposed rule amends Part 49 to update the requirements to verify swap data with reporting counterparties, update requirements to correct swap data errors and omissions, and update and clarify certain SDR operational governance requirements. On February 20th, the CFTC reopened the comment period for this rule, which was first proposed and published on May 13th, 2019. The comment period was set to end on May 20th, but was extended 2 days to May 22nd. Amendments to real-time public reporting requirements. The proposed rule amends Part 43's real-time public reporting requirements. A key feature of this proposed rule is the delay in reporting for block trades. With the implementation of the agency's Dodd-Frank regulations in 2011, the CFTC initially settled on phasing in a 15-minute delay for most block or large notional trades. The proposed rule increases such delay to 48 hours. However, the proposal also tweaks the definition for block trades, resulting in fewer transactions qualifying for such 48-hour delay. The Commission passed this proposed rule on February 20th, with the comment period now extended and scheduled to close on May 22nd. Amendments to the swap data record keeping and reporting requirements. The thrust of this proposed rule is to streamline and simplify Part 45. Part 45 governs regulatory reporting, meaning swap data reporting that is sent to SDRs and is not publicly disseminated. The proposed rule includes a technical specification that identifies 116 standardized data fields that will help replace fields now in use by SDRs. The proposed rule also removes the current catch-all reporting requirement to report, quote, any other term of the swap matched or affirmed by the counterparties. This is another long-awaited fix to the Dodd-Frank rules, which will hopefully provide a logical approach to the necessary fields for swap data reporting and provide consistency to reporting across jurisdictions. The proposed rule was submitted on February 20th, with the comment period now scheduled to close May 22nd. As mentioned earlier, the Commission held an open meeting via teleconference on April 14th, during which three new rules were proposed. These rules, all amendments to existing regulations, arise out of former Chairman Giancarlo's Project KISS, in which the Commission asked the industry for suggestions on how to simplify and make less burdensome or costly the CFTC's existing rules, regulations, or practices. The amendments, in many respects, codify existing no-action relief or guidance. First are the amendments to Part 190 Bankruptcy Regulations. This is the first comprehensive overhaul of the bankruptcy regulations since 1983. Some of the highlights from the 437-page proposed rule include the following. The proposal contains changes to enhance customer protection through, one, strengthening rules to ensure shortfalls to segregated customer property will be made up by FCM general assets, two, a policy preference for transferring or, quote-unquote, porting customer positions to a solvent broker rather than liquidating those positions, three, the priority of public customers over non-public customers, and four, the entitlement of public customers to pro-rata distribution of assets. The proposed rule further codifies a number of common practices in commodity bankruptcies. For instance, it authorizes a bankruptcy trustee to treat a broker's customers in the aggregate for certain purposes, rather than handling each customer's account on a bespoke basis, which may be necessary for the disposition of a large number of derivative contracts on behalf of a large number of customers within a short time frame. The proposed rule also includes new rules governing the bankruptcy of a clearinghouse. The proposed rule favors following the DCO's existing default management and recovery and wind-down rules and procedures. This would allow the bankruptcy trustee to take advantage of an established playbook rather than have to form a resolution plan within a short window of time during a crisis. Finally, the proposed rule makes clear that an account class includes tangible and intangible property, to include virtual currencies, which are not accounted for under the current old regulations. The proposed rule has a 90-day comment period ending on July 13th. Amendments to compliance requirements for commodity pool operators on Form CPO-PQR. CFTC's Form CPO-PQR requests information regarding the operations of a commodity pool operator in each pool it operates. The proposed rule is designed to update and simplify the information required by the form. The proposed rule amends Schedule A to require the collection of legal entity identifiers for CPOs and their operated pools, and to eliminate questions regarding auditors and marketers. The proposed rule also eliminates pool-specific reporting requirements in Schedule C and most of Schedule B, only retaining the Schedule of Investments reporting in Form B. The proposed rule specifies that the SEC Form PF will no longer be accepted in lieu of the CFTC's Form CPO-PQR. However, the CFTC will accept the National Futures Association's Form PQR in lieu of its form, as the proposed changes to the Form CPO-PQR would better align it with the NFA Form PQR. The proposed rule has a 60-day comment period, which is ending on June 15th. Finally, there are the amendments to Part 50 swap clearing requirements exemptions. Among other technical amendments to Part 50, the proposed amendments codify existing exemptions from the clearing requirement for swaps entered into with certain central banks, sovereign entities, and international financial institutions. This confirms a longstanding policy of the CFTC to exempt these type of institutions as a matter of international comity and recognition of the reduced risk they pose. The proposed rule would also codify no-action relief that exempted from the clearing requirement certain swaps entered into by small bank holding companies, savings and loan holding companies, and community development financial institutions, if the institutions have less than $10 million in assets and they enter into the swaps for hedging or risk mitigation purposes. Even though this amendment was proposed originally in 2018, the Commission is now seeking additional comment based on some revisions and the proposed restructuring of Part 50 already contemplated by these proposed amendments. This proposed rule has a 60-day comment period following its publication in the Federal Register, which I think it has yet to publish. Although there have not been any future announcements, it was believed that the Commission did have additional rules slated to be proposed in the coming months, such as a revised proposed rule on automated trading. It is unclear whether the schedule has been severely impacted by COVID-19, thereby delaying the rules for some amount of time, or whether the imminent departure of Commissioner Quintanz will seriously hamper the chairman's agenda. But by June, I think the picture will be more clear as what the path forward for the commission will be. Perhaps this is just my unending hopefulness that all will return to normalcy soon. The fact that June also coincides with the end of the school year and thus the end of distance learning has nothing to do with my thinking at all, I swear. Finally, we will turn to CFTC enforcement to provide some update on recent cases and trends. Seemingly, since the COVID-19 pandemic caused offices to close, the CFTC enforcement activity has seemingly slowed down, but to be clear, it has not stopped. Between March and April, the CFTC only brought one enforcement action compared to 9 actions brought in January and February. The single action, announced on April 16th, involved charges against a Florida company for fraudulently soliciting customers to purchase a digital asset known as CompCoin. According to the CFTC allegations, CompCoin allowed the customers to gain access to the company's proprietary Forex trading algorithm, which the company claimed, according to the CFTC, would deliver higher rates of return. This kind of case is typical for the CFTC as part of its mission to protect retail investors from fraud, and I think you will continue to see additional cases in the fraud sector, whether it involves digital assets, virtual assets, whether it involves Forex, metals, et cetera. That has long been a core of the enforcement program at the CFTC, and there should be no expectation that will change in the coming months. The slowdown in enforcement matters likely is due in part to the transition of the enforcement division to remote working environments and the logistical challenges that brings for staff trying to access and review documents and data that are part of their investigations. Also, the agency has been otherwise focused on completing proposed rules and responding to COVID-19. But the division is currently bringing cases to the commission for consideration, and as noted earlier, a closed commission meeting to consider enforcement matters was scheduled to take place this Monday. Further, the CFTC's fiscal year ends on September 30th. This usually results in a higher number of actions announced over the summer as the agency and the division get ready to prepare their annual reports summarizing the year's activities. So what can we expect from the CFTC enforcement going forward? Several topics beyond the straight fraud cases I previously discussed have been the focus of the agency for the past year. Traditional white-collar investigations such as market or price manipulation and spoofing in the markets continue to be priorities for the division. This is particularly true as the Department of Justice remains focused on these types of cases and is working in parallel with the CFTC on a task force to investigate at least the spoofing cases. Further, the CFTC, through its enforcement director, last year announced its intent to bring cases in parallel to DOJ investigations conducted under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. While the CFTC clearly does not have jurisdiction under the FCPA, the Division of Enforcement does believe that certain fact patterns subject to the FCPA may have an impact on the markets the CFTC oversees and thus may be subject to CFTC oversight if such conduct also results in a violation of the Commodity Exchange Act, for example, market manipulation. While no such cases have been brought to date, there are several indicators that the CFTC is actively investigating these type of cases. It is possible one may get announced by September 30th, which is, again, the end of the agency's reporting year. So how do these kind of enforcement cases arise? They can stem from a variety of sources. The agency maintains a robust and active whistleblower office that receives scores of submissions weekly. The agency is actively looking for matters that warrant an award to whistleblowers should it lead to an investigation and a successful action brought by the agency. In fact, The whistleblower office of the CFTC just awarded on Monday $2 million to four whistleblowers. The division also utilizes proprietary surveillance programs written in-house by investigators who come from the industry. They use these programs to examine the troves of market data submitted to the agency and exchanges daily. The CFTC has access to years' worth of data and is able to comb through it to look for patterns of market disruptive behavior. No longer does the agency rely solely on substantiated reports or rumors to begin investigations. They are able to look for bad behavior in almost real-time fashion. Further, the agency has at its disposal the ability to send out special calls or demand information from registrants like swap dealers who are required to maintain certain information and provide it to the agency on demand. This allows the division to acquire information across an industry sector without seeking subpoena authority from the commission, and further allows the division to conduct investigatory sweeps of certain industry sectors. These kind of sweeps have been seen in the past, and often they were begun in the Division of Market Oversight when the surveillance system was solely located in DMO. But under the prior chairman, Giancarlo, this was bifurcated. So straight market surveillance, just to understand what's happening in the markets, remains in DMO, while market surveillance to look for bad behavior was moved up and into Enforcement Division. Market volatility, such as the kind that has been created by COVID-19, is another area in which the CFTC will actively look for bad actors. We all watched as the oil markets last week dove into negative prices. While there's been no news that indicates this was caused by any particular actor, the CFTC is certainly reviewing data to ensure only natural market forces were the cause of the price movements. As part of this review, it is likely that some investigations will be spurred, not just to explore whether an individual or company caused the market movements in total, but whether such supposed bad actors utilize the situations to engage in any manipulative behavior. The recent published guidance on actual delivery of retail commodity transactions and virtual currencies may also prove to be an area of enforcement focus over the coming months. The CFTC released this guidance on March 24 after several attempts to apply the concept of actual delivery in the cryptocurrency space. This guidance took a measured and practical approach in evaluating when actual delivery of virtual currency has occurred. While this measure likely was welcomed by the industry, it did come with what appeared to be an implicit warning when Chairman Tarbert stated, quote, for a period of 90 days, the CFTC will forbear from initiating enforcement actions addressing aspects of this guidance that were not plainly evident from prior applicable law. Participants in this space should therefore move quickly to review the applicability of the final guidance to their business and make certain that their business models align with the requirements for final guidance by the end of the 90-day grace period, which is June 22nd. We have just a little bit more to cover on CFTC enforcement, but given that we're near at the end of the half hour, I want to provide everyone with the CLE credit code. Please note that capitalization does matter. The code is lowercase h, uppercase g, 7-6. Again, that is lowercase h as in hotel, uppercase g as in golf, 7-6. And we'll continue. The agency is also focused on regulatory enforcement actions against registrants such as swap dealers, major swap participants, and FCMs. These actions include failures related to swap data reporting and record-keeping requirements. And over the past year, the CFTC has also brought actions based on violations of swap dealer risk management rules. This was a first-of-its-kind case, but market participants can expect others to follow at some point. And failures related to business conduct standards for registered swap dealers and major swap participants. An overarching violation that is often brought in conjunction with these regulatory actions is a violation for failure to supervise, a catch-all provision utilized by the CFTC to take action against any conduct it perceives as inappropriate by holding financial institutions accountable for shortcomings in their systems and controls. These regulatory enforcement cases are easy for the CFTC to bring and prove, as they are per se violations that do not require proof of intent. Cooperation, self-reporting, and remediation continue to be big themes in all enforcement matters. This demonstrates that market participants must not only have robust policies and procedures and compliance mechanisms, But also, market participants should have early identification of problems and communications of those problems with the commission in order to stave off more costly and time-consuming investigations, large fines, and the imposition of onerous undertakings. And it goes without saying that regular reviews and audits of internal systems and controls could help prevent against an enforcement action altogether. That completes our agenda for today. Again, this program was simply intended to provide an overview touching upon key subjects of CFTC. I am happy to address any questions at this time. Of course, if there is any portion of this program you wish to hear more about, please do not hesitate to reach out to me. We would be happy to discuss these matters in more detail. Again, for those interested in CLE credit, the following code is to be recorded on the remote attendee affirmation form. Please note one more time that capitalization matters. The code is HG, lowercase h, uppercase G, 76. Again, that is lowercase h as in hotel, uppercase G as in golf, 76. I did get one question about how does the CFTC bring an FCPA style case? This is something the industry has been waiting to see for some time. What is likely to happen is that the fact pattern that results in an FCPA case also has some sort of impact on the commodity markets. For example, if someone tried to bribe a government official to influence a benchmark that is put out on a commodity and then trades on that commodity in the market off of that information, the CFTC likely would be a 6C1 market manipulation case. It's an easy case to bring because it has a lower standard of intent, reckless disregard, as well as potentially specific intent. And I know that the Division of Enforcement has been in active discussions with DOJ about the type of cases they have to see where the CFTC could possibly bring an action. These are the kind of FCPA cases that would not otherwise be covered by another civil regulatory agency. Often you see FCPA cases covered by the SEC. But in a situation like the fact pattern I just came, the SEC would have no jurisdiction. This allows the CFTC to take action and protect what it believes to be its markets impacted by this conduct. As I mentioned at the start of the program, this is the sixth of our teleconference series. We hope you found this to be of value and will continue to join us over the next few weeks, including next week joining our colleagues Chris DeCrees, Burr Eckstedt, and Tishe Sherman. Their session will focus on recent developments in the fintech industry post the COVID-19 crisis. They will give you a look at how the COVID-19 crisis is accelerating the digitalization of the financial services and changing the business and legal landscape of fintech. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website at www.cov.com and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both are included in the meeting materials. Finally, one more time, that CLE code is lowercase h as in hotel, uppercase g as in golf, 76. Again, thank you for joining us today. If you have any questions following the call, please feel free to reach out to me at any point. In the meantime, be safe and have a great rest of the week. Thank you.